showing their concern on this issue. I think people have to continue to raise this issue with their elected officials and to tell them that they really do care. We had, when we opened the door to comments, we had overwhelming responses from the public, thousands and thousands of comments that overwhelmingly supported our taking stronger action, providing more rules, providing clear guidance.
I want to thank you very much for joining us, Federal Election Commissioner Ellen Weintraub. And that does it for our show. We're beginning our 100-city 20th anniversary tour. You can go to our website at democracynow.org. I'll be in Ithaca College April 6th. That's Wednesday. Columbus, Ohio at Ohio State University on the 8th. St. Louis, Columbia, Missouri and Kansas City on the 9th. Los Angeles Times Book Festival in Santa Barbara on the 10th. After that, in San Francisco at City Arts and Lectures on the 11th. Stanford University and then Santa Clara on the 12th. Santa Cruz on the 13th. Check out democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkner, Amin Sheikh, Carla Wales, Walter Gardensteiner. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. It takes all of us to keep KBOO strong. Did you know that you can give gifts of stocks to KBOO? We're able to quickly turn these donations into support for the important daily work of KBOO. How do you do this? You call 503-231-8032 or email development@kboo.org for information on how to make a stock gift or a gift of appreciated securities. And we thank you. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Today we'll try to explain the appeal of Republican candidate Donald Trump.
KBOO Community Radio, along with Street Roots Newspaper, is proud to co-sponsor Amy Goodman's Portland appearance Sunday, May 8th at the Aladdin Theater. She'll be talking about Democracy Now! 20 years covering the movements changing America. Her new book, co-authored by David Goodman and Dennis Moynihan. And Amy will be doing a book signing after the talk. All proceeds go to benefit KBOO and Street Roots Newspaper. Again, that's Amy Goodman on Sunday, May 8th at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/democracynowbenefit. Democracy is coming to the
USA. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Smoldering Fires, produced by Passenart. The play runs from March 11th through April 10th at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center in Portland. Smoldering Fires explores how to apply the ideas and struggles of the civil rights movement to contemporary city life through the point of view of two young friends who differ in temperament and approach. Again, that's Smoldering Fires, March 11th through April 10th at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center, 5340 Northeast Interstate Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Tom Dwyer Automotive Services, a full-service automotive shop located next to Portland's Selwood Bridge for over 30 years. They're a Blue Seal certified shop committed to client care and community support. Information on their eco-certification, client carbon neutral program, courtesy shuttle, rentals, and more at tomdwyer.com or by calling 503-230-2300.
Oh, yes.
Good morning.
Sig Heil.
What?
That is the march of the riding brigade of the Nazis.
Oh, I see.
Actually, pre-Nazi, I think.
Traditional.
You know, people tuning into this show for the first time just turned off their radios.
Yeah, really? Hey, we do Nazi stuff. No. It is interesting as we watch America slide inevitably and inexorably into fascism. This is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
Yep, it is.
It is.
Yeah.
It's Abe Proctor, that's him,
uh-huh.
And Joe Uris, that's me. It is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, yeah. 231.
See how that works?
231-8187. It's an exciting day. The weather is decent. And there are these people running for president of the United States.
Yes. And before we get into that.
Okay.
I think I need to briefly address something I said on last week's show.
Did you say something wrong?
I did. I alluded to the, and I believe my choice of words was the aura of untrustworthiness surrounding Secretary Clinton.
Oh.
That was both unfair and inaccurate.
Oh, so you think she's trustworthy?
Well, let me explain.
Okay.
So I won't apologize for that comment. I don't think that was fair, nor was it accurate. Secretary Clinton, whatever aura of untrustworthiness exists around her, is entirely the product of the unhinged and rabid anti-Clinton sentiment that runs through the right wing. Perhaps the only thing that Republicans hate more than Obama is somebody with the last name of Clinton.
Especially a Lady Clinton.
A Lady Clinton, right. None of the myriad investigations into her alleged misdeeds has turned up a shred of evidence implicating her in any of those affairs, from the email dust-up to Benghazi. There's nothing.
Or even before.
Yeah, even before.
During the stormwater investigation.
Right. Or stormwater.
Sorry.
Right. Whatever problems you might have with her politics, that's fine. But there's no evidence to indicate that she's untrustworthy. So,
well, I think that's true. In fact, I think she's pretty out front about her beliefs, which
I don't happen
to share often.
Yeah.
But that's... And I want to tell people that there's something very important happening on Thursday.
Uh-huh.
Isn't Thursday April 7th, or have I already missed it?
No. It's still April 7th.
Okay. So that would make today the 5th.
That's right.
Okay. Whew. All right. I didn't fall asleep for...
Tough being retired, isn't it?
Yeah, well, tough being retired and, you know, Rip Van Winkle and all that. Anyway, emergency rally for rent control, which we really need, and an eviction-free Portland. It's going to take place at 9 a.m. at the Multnomah County Building, 501 Southeast Hawthorne. And whether or not you're a renter, whether or not you want to be a renter, this is an important event because Portland rents, I think people know this, but Portland rents have just, like many cities actually, particularly on the West Coast, have soared. New York City is another example. And it's particularly harsh on working people. Or would-be working people. In fact, the middle class, even. And I think this is a thing to do. I think I'm going to go there.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I think it's important.
You should let us know how that went.
How that turns out. Yeah. Well, I imagine it'll be boring.
Oh, okay.
Because everything's boring. Everything political is boring. There's no real excitement unless some bunch of young folks decide that the thing to do politically is fight the police, which I've noticed in Portland is a thing, which I consider to be about as silly as, I don't know, fighting the army or something. Anyway, no, don't call about that. That's just an aside. I urged us to talk a little bit about the candidates. I know we've done a lot of stuff on this election, but it's really important to look at these people their appeal, their authentic appeal.
Can you recall another election like this in your lifetime? I certainly can't.
Another election like this?
Yeah.
No.
I mean, there's just so much crazy out there right now.
Well,
it's astonishing.
It's not just that it's crazy. It's crazy is out there. I mean, it's actually visible.
It
touchable.
Is. Oh, yeah.
Observable.
Yeah, both major parties are facing big internal schisms. Large chunks of voters are breaking with the establishment and its prerogatives and the establishment-sanctioned candidates.
Well, and we have to be careful. Just to our audience, I have to point out, because we're a nonprofit, and believe me, we are satisfied with that status, because we are a nonprofit, we are not allowed to advocate for candidates.
That's correct.
But I'm not sure we can't diss them. I don't know what the law is on that, but we'll see. Anyway, I wrote the candidates down that are still in the game, and wanted to talk about some of them. I think I wanted to start maybe with Clinton, actually.
Would you?
I will.
Okay.
Okay. Here's the problem, as I see it, mm-hmm. which you out there may not share. Bill Clinton, charming fellow, he of the stained dress. I can't resist.
Yeah, I know. I know. And that's why the level of discourse stays so high on this show.
Yes,
because of your self-control.
Oh, it's me that you're blaming for this. And although some mistakes do occur apparently under your watch.
Yeah, from time to time.
Anyway, Bill Clinton, as far as I'm concerned, sold out the working class and definitely turned the Democratic Party away from its classic working class roots. And he did that through a series of legislative reforms, one of which he proudly announces doing away with welfare as we know it, mm-hmm. which essentially made large numbers of poor people, many of them unemployed or even unemployable, suddenly more desperate. In the midst of that, he also turned attention to trade and created NAFTA. He didn't create it, but went for NAFTA and various other programs, which allowed big businesses to make many more and many better deals in an international marketplace, which meant that essentially poor farmers growing corn in Mexico would suddenly find themselves overwhelmed with American corn products, which meant that large numbers of Mexican farm workers and Mexican farm owners would move north in order to survive, which meant that suddenly we had a crisis, I put quotes around that, of many, many people seeking work crossing our border, which in turn allows us to have the craziness of Trump talking about Mexicans in America as if they were some kind of horrible force. And this is important, though, because it really is a reshaping of the relationship between Mexico and the United States. I would point out just very briefly that we have used Mexican labor during World War II, for example, under a Bracero program, which lasted well into the 50s and 60s, which made it possible for Mexican workers to work in, particularly in the agricultural industry, but also in the meatpacking industry and others, and be legitimately here for a period of time. So that's, you know, so Clinton essentially, I charge, destroyed the poorest people's security under welfare, created an enormous class of desperate people who are American citizens, and at the same time created a situation in which there could be real aggravation and anger, which becomes legitimized in the hands of a crazy like Trump.
Drumpf.
Yes, his real name's Drumpf.
Okay. Family name. All right. So that's number one.
Well, but
under
it's
Bill Clinton's.
Yeah, and then along comes Hillary, ambitious and bright, who I think as Secretary of State was no big deal, except bad, to my thinking, mm-hmm. but more important than that, also as a senator serving New York well. She becomes a significant figure in before that, in 08.
You forgot a big Bill Clinton thing.
Which one?
Well, you hit welfare reform.
Yeah.
And you hit the trade agreement.
Oh, I know what I forgot. I forgot the incarceration of African Americans.
The crime bill of 1994.
Yeah, that's really important. Suddenly,
perhaps the biggest whopper of all.
Yeah, in which we create not only a huge class of people forever in jail, in and out and in, and we create the private prison industrial complex.
Yes, and we disempowered one of the most important branches of our government in terms of upholding the rights of citizens, the judiciary, by imposing upon judges mandatory minimum sentences. Huge, really strict mandatory minimum sentences for innocuous things like possession of a small amount of marijuana, for example.
Yes.
Thousands of Americans in jail for long periods of time for what are essentially nonviolent, victimless crimes.
And oddly enough, most of those in jail for these small crimes seem to be persons of color.
Yes.
Isn't. Three strikes law.
Yes. Included in that crime bill was this notion of three strikes, you're out. Again, taking discretion out of the hands of the judiciary. A really negative and unfortunate development.
So that's Hillary's, I would say, unfortunate legacy.
Yeah.
Her opponent in this election, Bernie Sanders, has never been a player within the traditional Democratic Party.
No. In fact, he hasn't been Democrat
Until he decided to be a Democrat.
Until he decided to run for president.
Right.
Yeah.
He, I think, and I have not talked to him, so I don't know, but I think he entered this to emphasize the issues he felt were really important, mm-hmm. which is the Citizens United
yep.
decision and the fact, I mean, the very real fact that the elections are not fair.
Well, yes, and the emergence of an absolutely dominant, incredibly wealthy ruling class, the
yep.
Wall Street that he rails about again and again and again.
Yeah, and to his amazement, I think, actually, he was unprepared for this, it caught fire.
It did. And New York Times ran a really sort of silly story over the weekend about that. Did you happen to read it?
I did not.
The New York Times talked to people inside the Sanders campaign. They talked about the early stages of his campaign where he really didn't believe at that point that he had any legitimate shot at winning the nomination and was intending to run his campaign as a protest campaign. And then it started to catch fire. It was a big surprise to both Bernie and his campaign. So essentially the gist of this Times piece was that Bernie has run an unbelievably incredible campaign, and if only he had been twice as incredible from the very beginning, he might have the thing in the bag by now, which is both inaccurate and unfair on behalf of the Times.
Well, and there's there's a lot about this Democratic race that is important, among which is the fact that Hillary Clinton is a woman. We have never had a woman president. This is an extremely important opportunity. We have had an African-American president who was actually so vigorously attacked, suggesting that he was a Muslim, suggesting he was not born in this country, suggesting anything they could possibly come up with that would disenfranchise him.
Right. He has been portrayed and attacked as fundamentally illegitimate by the right since before he even took the office. It's shameful, really.
I'm
not, as time has gone on, I have come to look more favorably on Obama's presidency. And before you call and tell me all about drone strikes, et cetera, believe me, it's not been a perfect presidency. But on balance, he's been a decent president, I think. And the vitriol that has been thrown at him from the right is an embarrassment to all of us. And we should all refute that going forward. There's no place for that sort of business. No excuse for approaching the American president and essentially saying, show us your papers, please, Mr. President. It's offensive on every level.
Well, what about Cruz? Maybe he should show us his papers.
Maybe Cruz should. Well, we'll get to Ted here
we'll
in a little bit.
Yeah.
The Constitution, I believe, is fairly unambiguous on the point that it is the prerogative of the president to nominate a judge when there is a vacancy on the Supreme Court.
Yes.
There is, at present, a vacancy on the Supreme Court. And in a final statement about his perceived illegitimacy, the Republican Party is denying a sitting president his right under the Constitution to put forth a nominee.
Well, it's like his fourth year of his second term is not his.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
that's pretty amazing.
It is, yeah, and again, offensive on so many levels.
Well, and let's be clear about a couple of things people may not know. The Supreme Court number 9 is not in the Constitution. It could have been more or less members. It's not specified in the Constitution. It's become customary. And the idea of having an odd number is so that decisions could be made.
Right, there wouldn't be a tie.
Okay, so we set that aside for a moment, and let's just turn immediately to the wonderful Republican
Party.
No.
I have a few more things to say about Secretary Clinton.
Okay. Now, okay.
In what is...
Wait, let me say okay again. Okay.
Okay. Nobody paying attention to this election should overlook this fact. This is an extraordinary thing. Secretary Clinton is widely perceived as the favorite establishment candidate for the Democratic Party. Now, let's pause to consider for a moment how earth-shaking it actually is that a woman has been welcomed as the establishment candidate, when for all of human history, being part of the establishment meant that you were not a woman. That's an extraordinary thing, and we should be cognizant of that, whether or not you support Secretary Clinton.
Well, I agree. Outies and innies apparently are a big deal. Okay, so right. there's that.
And again, it's profound statements like that that keep people tuning in.
I try to be on top of the intellectual efforts.
Here. I know you do. You do. Yeah. And we all
I are a doctor. Okay.
We should say 231-8187 is the number if you want to join this conversation. We'll also take your comments on Facebook. That's facebook.com/AbeandJoe.
Maybe you could elevate it. People could elevate the conversation.
Well, we certainly have nowhere to go but up from this
well,
point.
Yes.
You can also get in touch on the Twitter machine. That's at HonestAbe72.
And we should talk now about the Republican candidates.
Let's do that.
Being fair. What I find interesting, Kasich, whose politics is an anathema to me, mm-hmm. who's actually very bad on every issue I can think of, is nevertheless the most rational and the most intelligent and the most experienced and the most trustworthy of all of the Republican candidates. Isn't that weird?
So to sum up what you just said, he's not crazy.
He is not crazy.
Okay.
He does not present himself as vicious, although much of the legislation he created is pretty mean.
But that's what passes for acceptability in the Republican Party right now. Well, he's not crazy.
No, he's not crazy, and he's not. He actually knows how to handle people. He knows how to interact. He's pleasant in interaction. And then the next candidate in order of this bizarre thing is Ted Cruz.
Okay, crazy.
Well, crazy, believed to eat children, often known for his, I don't know, what do you want to call it? I mean, just, ew.
Okay, a certain oleaginous approach.
You mean he's greasy?
Greasy, oily?
Well, that may be racist there. I don't know.
No, really?
Yeah, white people are greasy.
Oh.
This is a well-known fact. Okay.
Sorry, white people, for associating you with Ted Cruz. Who looks pretty much like a white guy, right?
Yeah, he might not be an American eligible for the presidency because he was born in Canada.
Right.
Which is another country.
Right.
And the Constitution seems to say you got to be born here.
Indeed. So maybe he needs to show us his birth certificate.
Well.
Your papers, please, Senator Cruz.
I think he's going to get away with that part of it, because I think the Republican Party at this point is desperate to knock out, and here we come with it, Drumpf, who became Trump. His father became Trump. Mm-hmm. And they got a lot of money in the real estate business in New York, which was, if you had money, was not hard to make more of at various times. And he is so huge and marries such models mm-hmm. and creates such charming children and is such a wonderful fella, you know, the best of the best.
Right. Well, he's a winner.
But I really do want to.
It's going to make America great.
But I really do want to focus in on why he's popular and what it means. First of all, we earlier talked about how essentially the Democratic Party, I believe, and I think you agree with me, stepped away from its working class roots.
It did.
And moved towards a kind of intellectually based middle class idea of the world. An internationalist view, if you will, but not necessarily a democratic small d internationalism, but rather a very capitalist notion of internationalism and a notion of legitimate imperialism. So in all of that, many, many people faced unemployment or inability to go to college. College disappeared for most people. When I was going to college, way back when horses and buggies were common, the fact of the matter was that state schools, both community colleges and universities, were close to free.
Yeah.
And, I mean, in fact, the University of California, Berkeley was free. You know, Portland State was free or virtually free.
Yeah, but we can't afford that now.
Well, no, we can't afford that now because we got to drone things. And
well, right. And we got to give tax cuts.
Build new atomic bombs.
We got to give tax cuts to wealthy people so stuff can trickle down on us.
Yeah, trickling down. Anyway, in all of that, Drumpf ends up being a vaguely charismatic, I say vaguely in the sense of intellectually, but in terms of people's feeling, representative of the aggrieved, legitimately aggrieved, working class in America.
Legitimately aggrieved.
Yeah. Hmm. If you are a white for a working class man
mm-hmm.
Trying to make it in this environment, you really do feel challenged, to survive.
Certainly.
Now, whether that's a real thing or a feel thing, we can argue.
Well, let's unpack that for a second.
Yeah.
Okay. White working class males are feeling the wolves at the door, as it were.
They're knives at their you know what.
Well, the threat of I'm just going to let that one go.
Okay.
The threat of economic dislocation.
Yes.
Right. That said, if you're feeling that way, if you're one of these white voters, male voters, it seems to me that you're probably going to gravitate towards one of two candidates in this field. You're going to gravitate towards Trump or Bernie.
Right.
Now, how do you make that decision? And I think the grounds on which you make that decision and where you end up after making that decision says everything about you, and really, I think, delegitimizes that sense of being aggrieved that you just talked about. I'd say Trump voters, while yes, they might be feeling economically dislocated, they're also eating up the racist raw meat that their candidate throws them every day. They don't look at their economic dislocation and point the finger at the obvious place, which is the incredibly rich ruling class and the fallout of global capitalism. They don't do that. They say it's the brown people who are pouring over the borders to take our jobs. They say it's the liberals who are coming to take our guns. They say it's the liberals who are telling us we can't we can't practice our religion the way we want to anymore. They don't blame the right people for their economic dislocation.
Well, that's true. And blaming the victim is an American-style thing. In fact, it's a thing in every culture, unfortunately. But what's really also interesting and really important is that these are, most of them, working class. Like we now use the term middle class for anybody that has a job, which I think is funny. But these are people who essentially have reasonable grievances. Which we've talked about a little bit, you know, the lack
sure.
of education and so on.
Yeah.
And they are angry and they are looking for an explanation. And there is, we have created in our society an enormous network of radio talk shows, of huge monies from the wealthy upper classes that pours into the propaganda that creates this grievance. And we're seeing it. Trump realized it or didn't even realize it, just stepped into the game for his own egotistical reasons, and is now probably, very possibly, going to end up being the candidate of the Republican Party, as it were.
Well, maybe not. We'll get to that in a little bit as well.
Yeah.
But we should pause for a second and say this is KBOO 90.7 FM. If you want to join this conversation, you can do that. 503-231-8187.
Is that 231-8187?
Yes.
Okay.
I
wasn't clear.
On the Twitter machine at HonestAbe72. Or on the Facebook at facebook.com/AbeandJoe. David writes into Twitter to say, was there ever a time in history when crowds at POTUS rallies were undecideds there to learn instead of the rabidly faithful? I would say yes. I was at such a rally, 2004, for Howard Dean, where I stood with a group of people who were undecided but very interested to hear what Governor Dean had to say. And left that rally as Dean's supporters, but came to it undecided.
Yeah, and they knocked him out because he yelled, and all you heard on the thing was not the crowd roaring with him, but
right.
him alone.
Yeah, apparently that was just, he was a little too enthusiastic.
Yeah.
All right. So let's go to the phones. Bijan, good morning.
Good morning. When I look at the legacy of the Clintons, when they moved to the right, to get to the center, what choice did the Republicans have but to go even further right to distinguish themselves from Democrats? So when Democrats took on a lot of causes that were on the right, what else could the right wing do but even go further right?
You mean the Democrats?
No, the Republicans had to go further right.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Move to the center, but they actually move center right.
So, do you think that's the reason for the rightward drift in the Republican Party? A response to the Democrats, or is it because of innate beliefs?
Well, I mean, it's always been under the surface, and the Republican establishment has lost control because the Democrats took some of their viewpoints and talking points and moved to the center, so the Republican establishment drifted rightward, and the grassroots of the Republican Party went way further right. I think that's the real legacy of the Clintons. And I reject when it comes to, you know, it's a very historic thing that Hillary Clinton is a woman in the establishment, could be the president. I do accept that, but I reject this kind of bourgeois feminism that comes at the expense, that empowers white women at the expense of women and children of color. And if you look at her foreign policy and her some of the legacy of her decisions as Secretary of State, like in Honduras, I think or with the welfare reform bill of Bill Clinton, it's hurt women and children of color.
Could you elaborate what you mean about bourgeois feminism?
There's an article online. It's called Rejecting the Bourgeois Feminism of Hillary Clinton. And I just read that last night to it illustrated some of the things that and feminism that empowers white women and kind of shuts down the voices of women of color, how that's been kind of a common thread and kind of a back and forth in the feminist movement.
And yet, many, many older, I would say middle age and older African-American women particularly favor Hillary. I mean, we know that demographically. And it comes out of, I think, a longstanding tradition of perception of the role of the Democratic Party, ignoring things that, such as the question of incarceration of African-American men.
Well, to the Clintons' credit, I think they were the first Democratic president to actually embrace African-American culture, you know, when he went on Arsenio Hall and played saxophone, to really speak to the African-American community as people and not just a demographic that they need to win. So...
Okay, think, well,
but their policies did not help them.
Okay, we're gonna wind your call up. I want to remind people we got this 3-minute limit so we can get as many people in as possible. I do appreciate the call, and I think it's an interesting observation about Hillary. Remember, we're talking about Trump. We're talking about all of the candidates and their advantages and disadvantages. We Abe and I cannot advocate. We're not allowed to advocate for any of these candidates. So it's up to you. Or to attack them. That's also up to you. We can attack them, I guess. And it's kind of, okay. 231. Can we? No, we can't. 231-8187.
Who's next, Steve? Howard, good morning.
Good morning. I have a theory, and I want to share it with your audience and you.
Sure.
About why it is that Democratic presidents in their second term always sell us out.
Always.
You want to hear it?
Sure. Go for it.
Yeah, always. Well, it's another bad idea brought to you by the GOP, which is term limits for presidents. If you get a fairly young president who has no hope of re-election, like Bill Clinton or President Obama, they are going to want to cut themselves a deal for their post-presidency, and that means they're not going to make $25 million or more on the speaker circuit unless they please the corporate paymaster. So the way you do that is you sell out the American people with a trade agreement. And that's what's going on with TPP. That's why Bill Clinton did it, and that's why Barack Obama did it. It's the GOP, another bad idea of the party of bad ideas. And it's the 22nd Amendment that gives term limits to the president, that gives the presidents the authority, the incentive to do what they do.
Okay, well, that's an interesting idea, and I want to thank you for it.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the call. I don't agree.
Okay.
But so goes. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. You're looking at me like.
Well, I'm looking at you like I'm looking at you. What are you trying to say? This is not television.
I don't agree. Let's game that out for a second. Let's say that there was no limit of 2 terms for a president of the United States.
Okay.
Barack Obama would presumably be running for re-election right now and presumably would win.
Very popular, actually.
You need to ask yourself, yes, is that... is that best for the United States right now? My answer would be no. I think 8 years of executive power is enough for any one person. Anything longer than that, and you're starting to look a little bit more like a monarch than a president.
Oh, I don't buy that. I really don't. I don't know that the two-term limit is anything more than a political maneuver, as you're suggesting. That's another question. But I do see I do see some real problems with what happened with Roosevelt. Roosevelt's last term. Now, of course, this is during World War II. Roosevelt's last term was everyone knew who knew him, actually knew him, knew that he was mortally ill. There was a very important decision to be made about who would be vice president, therefore. And the pressure of the centrists and Southern Democrats, remember the party that was the Democratic Party was Dixiecrats, which is to say racist anti-black Democrats from the South, together with organized labor, together with big city machines, and so on, which was the odd combination that the Roosevelt people had put together. They did not want Henry Wallace, who was a liberal left kind of guy, and he was then vice president of the United States. So they essentially manipulated him out of place and chose Harry Truman, who had many good ideas, including what could have been a national health insurance program. But Harry Truman was hardly a liberal, hardly an internationalist, and hardly a character like Henry Wallace. The result of that was a movement to the right of the Democratic Party for a long, long period of time. Now, that is an indication that Roosevelt, I believe, should not have run in 44. On the other hand, we were in the middle of a war. He was incredibly popular. He was very charismatic. And he was hiding his health problems very effectively. So, yeah, you can argue the two terms should be a limit. But think, all of the ways in which we saved the way capitalism actually was saved by Franklin Delano Roosevelt could not have happened in a two-term limit system. So, I mean, it's a mixed bag.
Okay.
That's all I have to say about that. 231-8187.
Bob writes into the Facebook page, that's facebook.com/AbeJoe, to say or to ask, are undisabled white men truly suffering from unemployment more than all other groups? And the answer is no.
No, not at all.
Of course, unemployment amongst minority groups is higher and historically always has been.
Yes.
So very good point, Bob. Let's go back to the phones. Who do we have? Francis, good morning.
Hi. I want to speak a little bit about how Hillary has created her own untrustworthiness. It has nothing to do with the Republican Party.
Okay.
But I would like to say that Trump is what the Republicans asked for, and he's been blowing the dog whistle, but actually their Congress is... doing the work.
I think he's thrown the dog whistle away and he's saying it out loud.
Right. But the Congress is doing the action. It's not a right. It's the job of the president to appoint a Supreme Court justice, and Congress is not doing their job.
That's also a good point.
So, you know, that's called sedition, I think. But anyway, Hillary started out as a Goldwater girl.
Mm-hmm.
She's a year older than me. I remember what I was doing when she was a Goldwater girl. I was protesting the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
She was supporting Barry Goldwater, who also voted against the Civil Rights Act, by the way. Somewhere along the line, she changed to a Democrat, shortly thereafter, I believe. But while her husband was having that crime bill, she referenced the young people, the gang members in the streets as super predators.
I remember that.
Who need to be brought to heel, H-E-E-L. And that's exactly what the crime bill did in so many terrible ways. She refers to Henry Kissinger as a hero of hers. She's received over $250,000 per speech to Goldman Sachs and other Wall Street corporations.
Well, that's because she makes such brilliant speeches, you know.
Well, yeah, and she can't release the transcripts of those speeches. She says when her opponents do, she will, but she must be referencing Republicans because Bernie Sanders has never made a speech that was paid that much money for anything. His speeches are all public.
Mm-hmm.
Also, she and Bill and Bush Sr. and them have this some kind of foundation going on in Haiti where the earthquakes were.
Mm-hmm.
Her brother got, a permit that has never been allowed by the Jamaican or the Haiti government to do gold mining in Haiti. We don't talk about that. And the people who are fleeing Central America including the children, unaccompanied children, are fleeing Honduras, which is, while she was Secretary of State, the deposed president, elected president, tried to return after a military coup, and she objected to that, and had one of her friends, I think his name is Lanny Davis. He was a lawyer that helped her husband during his impeachment, but somehow Lanny Davis is involved with some business corporations down there in Honduras right now, so we don't know anything about that. Nobody talks about it, but you can't even get anybody to ask her questions about what happened in Honduras. But
well, that's true, that latter thing.
There's a whole lot of reasons why. And I know a lot of black people who do not support Hillary, never will, and they don't trust her, and they are supporting Bernie Sanders. And while she was a Goldwater girl, Bernie Sanders was being arrested in the civil rights movement. So,
okay.
Well, there you go. Bye-bye.
Well, thanks,
bye-bye.
Francis.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Actually, the things she said, I know to be true.
Yes, I would
agree. 231-8187, if you disagree or agree or whatever, you should call us.
That's a good segue into a point I've been wanting to make on today's program.
Go for it.
Actually, Francis just mentioned the dog whistle. Well, what does she mean by that? When she's talking about the dog whistle in the context of American politics, it means the system of racially coded language that conservatives have used to communicate with their racist voter base over the years. When Nixon talked about law and order, he was talking about black folks. When Reagan talked about welfare moms, he was talking about black folks.
Yeah, I want to interrupt really just briefly. I think it's really important to understand that Richard Nixon was not just a racist, but he was also an anti-Semite. I just want to throw that out.
Okay. When Reagan started his presidential campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, mm-hmm. where two civil rights workers and their African-American friend were murdered, that was a dog whistle. This is how, when it became unfashionable to be a public racist, this is how the Republican Party, with a wink and a nod to its base, said, yeah, we can't be racist out in the open anymore, but we're really with you. That's the dog whistle. But Donald Trump has thrown the dog whistle out. He has such a racial animus undergirding his campaign. You can see it in the ugliness at his rallies, the people of color who have been assaulted, when he talks about Mexicans being racists or rapists, and on and on and on.
Yeah.
He has thrown this out. There is no more dog whistle. Trump is saying openly that I'm with you, racist white people. I am your candidate. And you talked about white male voters feeling aggrieved, feeling threatened economically, feeling threatened racially, although it's all in their minds. This is why they're gravitating towards Donald Trump. It is not the politics of rationality. It is not because of his alleged business acumen. It is because he is a strong man. He is a political strong man. It is the politics of dominance. He doesn't, if you listen to his speeches, I encourage you all out there to go listen to a Donald Trump speech. He says nothing specific about anything he's going to do. He talks in broad terms about how we're going to win again, how we're going to hit back at all these countries who are laughing at us behind our back.
Well, and the notion that America is not great anymore, we're going to make America great again.
Make America great again. How? Well, I don't know. You hear a lot of very broad platitudes laced liberally with racism at a Donald Trump rally.
Well, just very briefly, this some weird things. I mean, he won't rule out using nuclear weapons. He says he wants to get rid of our role in NATO, which whatever you think about the struggles between the Soviet bloc and the Western bloc, certainly NATO checked the advances and interests of Stalinism in Europe.
Yeah. And if you look back at episodes earlier in the campaign, during those clown car debates when there were, 10 Republicans up there on the stage, think about the things he said to Jeb Bush, for example, when he called Jeb low energy, when he said nobody's excited about your campaign. And Jeb Bush didn't do anything to defend himself. That is the politics of dominance in action. Donald Trump stepped up, slapped Jeb Bush across the face. Jeb Bush stood there, did nothing. And Donald Trump, like the schoolyard bully that he is, laughed at him, and his supporters ate it up. His poll numbers skyrocketed. And here he is, the front runner for the Republican nomination. Make no mistake, this is the politics of dominance. nothing else.
Oh, well, there's even a part of a weird Republican race is that the only person who seems to be within range of challenging Trump is Ted Cruz, who I can't say, I'm not allowed to say anything about him. I'm not allowed.
Yeah, you are.
Well, he creeps me out, man.
Okay.
I mean, he just creeps me out. I'm but, sorry.
But the interesting thing about the twist that this campaign just took is that Trump just came off of one of the worst weeks a candidate has ever had on the campaign trail.
Yeah.
There was blunder after blunder after disaster after absolute catastrophe. Starting last week when he, on social media, released a photo showing side-by-side pictures of his wife and Ted Cruz's wife, along with a caption alluding that Ted Cruz was... his wife was ugly and Trump's wife was hot. So, you know, vote for me because I got a hot wife and I'm a dominant alpha male. Again, the politics of dominance. Then one of his high ranking campaign officials assaulted someone at a rally and is now under indictment for assault.
Well, what's funny is the person they assaulted is actually a right wing woman reporter.
Yeah, indeed. But then Trump doubled down, of course, and defended his campaign employee instead of doing the smart thing and firing him and cutting ties with him. And what is it? Does this give us a glimpse of how a President Trump is going to resolve threats in the future with similar sorts of behaviors? I don't know. Then again, he comes out and gives an interview where he talks about his willingness to use nuclear weapons against as yet unknown enemies. I mean, this is completely reckless. And again, the politics of dominance. He's the strong man. He's not afraid to nuke somebody that we don't even know about yet.
And I think a lot of Americans don't understand the difference between use of nuclear weapons and conventional weapons,
indeed,
by the way.
And then finally, during an interview last week with Chris Matthews, who, in my opinion, is not the greatest journalist in the world, but he did what nobody else has been able to do thus far.
He Jesuited him.
He pinned Trump down and got Trump to admit that were abortion to be illegal, then he, as chief executive, would punish women who sought an abortion.
Right. Well,
I mean, this is an epic series of flameouts on the campaign trail, and we have really yet to see what this is going to mean. This might be the window opening for the guy who creeps you out so much, Joe.
Well, it's true. But I just want to emphasize that. What I mentioned. It is really interesting to see a Jesuitically trained press person using the logics and rationality of what characterized great Jesuit thinking to kind of destroy Trump. I mean, he just looked like a fool. Anyway, you have to read some stuff.
We have to
do some more business.
Yes, we do. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Alternative Radio, Richard Falk speaks on U.S. special relationships in the Middle East. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, lawyer and economist James Henry explains what we have learned from the massive Panama Papers document leak.
Panama Papers!
Yeah, next week's show, I think.
I think so.
And commentator Eric LeConte discusses the impact that anonymous shell corporations have on the poor. At 11 on stage and studio, host D-May Roberts features the Amish Project at Portland Actors Conservatory, which revolves around the 2006 killing of 5 Amish girls in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And at 11:30, Art Focus host Andre Middleton interviews comic artist Stephen Christian about his work Island of Illtopia, a visual art series that follows the lives of 3 characters. All this and more coming up today on your listener-supported radio station, KBOO.
Yes.
Right. So now, this is the Abe and Joe Show.
Yes.
503-231-8187 is the number to call.
We're talking about the presidential candidates.
We are. And we're taking your comments. Let's go back to the phones. Sean, good morning.
Good morning, guys. Hey, I wish we could take Francis's excellent phone call and just play that on a loop for the voters in Wisconsin today. I mean, that's one of the best phone calls to KBOO I've heard in a long time.
Francis is consistently solid with her input.
Absolutely. If I was to add anything, I guess it would be I think more attention needs to be paid to what I think you're kind of getting at. It's the equating of financial success with masculinity.
Yeah, and with status. Yeah.
Yeah, there's really something creepy and weird going on. You know, like it's like the cult of the entrepreneur or the cult of the small business person. Or there used to be the phrase, a petty bourgeois mindset. I'd really like to know the origin of that phrase, if either one of you are familiar with that. But Thomas Frank, of course, had his book One Market Under God, and he talked about market populism, this notion that capitalism, that free markets somehow are on the side of the little guy, that everybody has the chance to become a successful small business person under capitalism. And I just like to say up front, I mean, I despise small business people, because I can't find another constituency that's more wrapped up in this notion of financial success equating with masculinity and with market populism, this whole it's a petty bourgeois mindset. It's just like Weimar Germany, where you had the small business people, the professionals. They were the ones that backed the National Socialists along with the wealthy industrialists. And the constituency that backs Bernie, they're the workers. They're the unemployed. They're the people who are struggling. So if you guys want to go after that phrase, the petty bourgeois mindset, I think that explains a lot about this.
Unfortunately, we don't have time, and if I start talking about Marx, everyone will get bored.
Oh, but it fits right in with this bizarre. Like, I got back from the Bernie caucuses, and we crushed Hillary over here in Washington, of course. But I was home maybe a couple days, and I saw this article online: "Dear men who vote for Bernie Sanders, you're not men at all." And it's just like this twisted,
wow,
bizarre. Like, I'm thinking of like the wife of Tony Soprano and The Sopranos. You know, women who don't care where the money comes from, but they just equate money with masculinity and success. So,
well, it believe me, I'm not defending this, but this is nothing new. Money and status have always gone hand in hand in the United States, and
well,
really
not
through,
just
through
the
human
United
history,
States, in the world.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, I'll let you go. Thanks.
Hey, thanks very much for the call.
All right.
David writes in to say, agree on the dog whistle issue. That's what's striking and seems to me largely new in a presidential race: naked, undisguised racism. And Revolution Livestream writes in to say, yep, Joe's right. The Dems were and actually still are racist. They just hide it better. They are all corrupt.
Is that what I said?
Not
really. Okay.
Let's go to the phones. Bill, good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to speak to Donald Trump, not because I want to attack him, but you were talking about a time when, I guess it was when you mentioned the three civil rights workers who were murdered. Mm-hmm. I think you have to look at it from the context that what they represented at that time was the vigilante white male who was protecting the white identity in America.
You mean the murderers, I guess?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So, I mean, while they were murderers socially, they were seen as the strong arm of the white Christian, I guess, who didn't want to see the world change, so to speak. I guess their world, I guess that was Donald Trump's better, greater America that excluded everyone who was non-white and male. Who wasn't male. But the idea that politically, it fascinates me that I don't know of one illegal immigrant, if that's what we want to describe them, who's come to this country and taken someone's job. Ultimately, you have to be given a job because someone wants to pay you less, not because they want to pay you more.
Or possibly because you're better skilled. I mean,
yeah, but this fight or this notion that somehow we've been divided to believe that first it was, you know, historically, I think we have to look back after slavery politically when it became a very hotly debated issue. It was black men were going to, you know, murder us and rape our women and take our jobs. And is that any different than...
Well, how about if they murder our women and rape us? I don't know.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, I however that goes, but it's kind of this rehashing of something that is politically divisive, and it's like, are we really falling for this late in this nation?
Yeah, right. It really feels like we should all be smarter than this.
Yes, and it's like, ultimately, who are giving the jobs to these people that are taking them? And most often these are people who are being exploited for the profit, you know, for the bottom line. So the notion that somehow politically we're going to be saved by Hillary or Donald or Bernie Sanders is really my point that I want to get at. Ultimately, we have a broken political system that the people no longer have control over. And until we are willing all to really sit down and say what's going on with our political system to where it's not accomplishing anything, it's like we're regressing as a society. Mm. And we're reverting to, I guess, kindergarten tactics to survive as a nation.
Well, 30 years of disinvestment in public education will have that effect on our country.
Well, you guys, great show as usual.
Hey, thank you so much.
All right.
Appreciate your comments. Tara writes into the Facebook page to say, it befuddles me how Trump supporters can hold on to his thread of nothingness. It's got to be the dominance they are drawn to. He's had it with government. We all have for various reasons. But I've got a classroom full of college freshmen who can stay on topic and stick to the issues better than Donald Trump. He's simply unfit to run the nation, period.
I'm not allowed to comment on that.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Derek, good morning.
Good morning. The best analysis I've seen about Donald Trump was several months ago. I may have been in Salon, where someone had done a survey of a bunch of voters and asked them a bunch of questions about their sort of political philosophy, and then started asking them about the candidates. And what correlated best with the Trump voters was authoritarianism, which is essentially
dominance.
Another word for this dominance business that you've been talking about. Exactly. But the questions that identified people as authoritarians were questions about child rearing. You know, would you rather have a child who is independent or a child who is obedient? That kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so they got around to figuring out people's political, social philosophies from questions about family and society, and then they asked people about who they supported. And I think that and there was this very tight correlation between authoritarian mindsets about societies and families and Trump supporters. You know, and that explains why some of the Christian right is still behind Trump, even though he's clearly clueless, you know, even about like how to explain books in the Bible and things like that.
Would agree with that.
And racism is another authoritarian sort of mindset. I don't think that Trump is winning, large percentages of people just like through his racism, but it's authoritarian, his sort of strongman, rhetoric up towards whomever, towards women, whomever that, make us great again.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that it's important to know the concept of the authoritarian personality. A number of professors coming out of the liberal and left traditions in Germany, later known as the Frankfurt School, fled to the West. One of them, Victor Adorno, became the key figure in writing about the authoritarian personality, and his studies showed that people who, in one dimension, for example, sexism, would show racism in another dimension. In other words, the authoritarian personality is as you characterize it. There were many people in this school of thought, and I'm very much impressed by them, very much influenced by them. The Frankfurt School is very important to understanding exactly how fascism works. And anyone who's curious, I mean, you can Google it. It's really worth looking at. I just wanted to say that. Okay.
All right. Move on. Thanks.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Thanks for the call. Mm-hmm. All right. 503-231-8187. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking...
No, ignore the buzzer there. That was... Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. Two important resources on authoritarianism are Eric Fromm's Escape from Freedom.
Right.
You can go to booktv.org. I heard an incredible presentation on Adolf Hitler and his ability to monologue, to speak for 4 hours. So I urge you to check this out. People surrender their freedom to the Grand Inquisitor for his promise of happiness. Bernie Sanders' office in Portland is going to be opening tomorrow at 6 o'clock at 2717 Northeast Broadway. And to me, Trump and Hillary are both kind of media creations, and the media should upend them. The media should be upending Hillary on account of her fundraising, her dependence on Wall Street, her special interest proclivity, her
funding through Saudi Arabia, her terrible voting record on Iraq and Honduras. But the media, of course, has lost its substance, and it's just become an entertainment, just a profit-driven vehicle. It's Bernie Sanders, who is a great New Deal advocate, a great Roosevelt supporter, and he would really revive our country. He would commit us to job creation and to social justice, to sharing resources, and to abandoning the myths. One important myth that I was reading about on Tax Justice Network is that the tax cuts financed by cuts in the public spending stimulate the economy and create jobs. So I wish you could reflect on that. That seems to be a bipartisan myth.
Well, it is, and unfortunately we're out of time, and I do appreciate your call. I want everyone to stay tuned because KBOO is the best in public opinion, in discussion, and amazingly, music.
Thanks, everybody, for your calls and comments today, and we'll see you next week. Democracy is coming to the USA.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Tim DeChristopher Lecture, Wielding the Power of Vulnerability, Thursday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Tim DeChristopher, as bidder 70, disrupted a Bureau of Land Management oil and gas auction in 2008 by outbidding oil companies for land parcels around Arches and Canyonlands National Parks in Utah. His actions led to a 21-month imprisonment. Again, that's a lecture by Tim DeChristopher titled Wielding the Power of Vulnerability, Thursday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. 90.7, it's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on alternative radio, Richard Fox speaks on U.S. special relationships in the Middle East. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and